the digital platforms are where millions of people are consuming their media each day. So being as visible as you can on there and having 10 people talk about you in a week instead of one big person on paper, this sort of domino effect of that over time really builds up.
It's the E-commerce Master Plan podcast, here to help you solve your marketing problems and grow your e-commerce business. Cutting through the hype to bring you inspiration and advice from the e-commerce sector and beyond. Here's your host, Chloe Thomas.
Hello and welcome. It's great to have you here. Thank you for hitting play and choosing to listen to one of our inspiring guests. Me and the team get so much joy when we see you guys raving about us on social or in lists or blogs. So it's only fair to repay that by giving a little shout out to the person who was kind enough to shout about us. So thank you, Gemma Longman, for sharing your feedback. Yes, Gemma Longman, I'm talking to you. Thank you for sharing your feedback on our chat with James from Cook. So glad you loved that episode. And most importantly, thank you for listening. In this episode, we're revisiting a past guest story. But instead of interviewing the founder of Seep again, we've got their new head of growth joining us, talking about how they're kicking off 2026 with super successful marketing and growth activity, how he balances acquisition with retention. We'll also be talking about how he is planning on capitalizing on the big influx of new customers they had last year when they appeared on Dragon's Den. Lots of interesting stuff, alternative advertising strategies. If you are focused on growth and marketing this year, this is a must listen. Make sure to listen to the end of the episode because you also don't want to miss out on my guest's top tips. And now to introduce our special guest. Ed Hamilton is the head of growth at Seep, a certified B Corp selling eco house cleaning tools. Founded in 2020, they are now on target for £10 million in sales this year via their Shopify store, plus Amazon and wholesale. Hello, Ed.
Hello, lovely to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
Very cool to have you here. How did you end up in the marvelous world that is e-commerce?
Well, I've always been in the advertising world, always loved marketing, media. I got started in a media planning and buying agency, quite a big one, actually, part of the Omnicom group, and worked on some, quite big, global, amazing brands. Loved it at the time. It felt very glamorous. I grew up loving watching Mad Men and things like that. So I've always been a very, very, very part of the advertising industry and loved it, really. And then I took the plunge to move to a D2C brand, a much smaller startup scale-up brand, and sort of fell in love with the ability to be agile and to contribute day to day and be quite scrappy and, loved getting to know how to grow revenue of a brand, really. And then I came across Seep and Laura and, was immediately quite inspired by her story and what she's built and the brand she's built. And, a lot of people will say sponges and cleaning tools aren't particularly glamorous sector to be in, but what's really exciting about it is that everyone washes up, and therefore you can have the ability to touch everyone in the UK if we wanted to. So I really feel quite excited about the opportunity that we've got in front of us.
It must have been quite the contrast going from the big Mad Men agency world to a startup. I mean, I had my career path went from Barclays Bank to high street retailer to ever decreasing size of business. So now it's me and a handful of freelancers. I found I love the dynamism and the getting your hands dirty and everything of the small business. I'm guessing because you haven't gone back to Mad Men world, you're fairly similar.
I did. I really enjoyed it. I liked the fact that you make your own luck and you can get stuck in and go and change X, Y, Z on a website and it's live in five minutes. And then suddenly you're seeing people react and behave off the back of those changes you've made on the website. And it felt like a complete opposite end of the spectrum where you'd be planning and talking about a particular campaign for 3 to 6 months with these big global multinational brands. And I just I loved and fell in love with the fact that you could, you can make your own luck and be in control of everything that quickly. So it was a big change and, culturally a big change. You really had to roll your sleeves up and be willing to get stuck into all kinds of jobs. But that suits my personality anyway. So I do think it is good for some people and bad for others, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things you find in your career, what size and style of business you actually want to be at. And life is so much better when you find the right one. But we're not here to talk about career paths. We're here to talk about SEEP and what you're up to at SEEP at the moment. You are the head of growth. You've been there for, at the time this podcast episode goes live, about 6 months, I think. And you are clearly doing pretty well because you were willing to put live on LinkedIn a post about how good January had gone. So starting in that role 6 months ago, how did you go about setting yourself up for success? You know, what I'm trying to ask is, what are the key levers you wanted in place as head of growth to make sure you had that success in the short term?
Well, firstly, I've been very lucky. I had joined the brand at the time when they were very much on the up. This time last year, sort of March 2025, we were on Dragon's Den. And since that point, Laura and the brand have gone from strength to strength and become a bit more famous and got more customers and therefore developed from there. And I sort of think come September, October time, they'd gone through the hump of Dragon's Den, they'd sort of reap the rewards of most of the benefits of that. And then it was back to, okay, let's, how do we get going again? And we tested a few things. And when I came in, we started to ramp up ad spend for the first time in a couple of months and really see where the levels were. And we found that people resonated with the ads, people resonated with Laura's story. And we just kept on optimizing from there and managed to be sort of one of the lucky brands you can keep on spending and not necessarily see a drop off of efficiency. And we've ridden that wave now. And, you know, you're now in a place where how do you keep that momentum going? And we're not probably here today to talk about the depths of the Meta algorithm, but it's changing fast. So we're trying to stay ahead of that and fuel that engine as much as possible has been what I've been focused on for the past sort of 4 to 6 months. And yeah, so far so good. But obviously there will come a point where things aren't quite as easy. So trying to stay ahead of the curve and spot the opportunities for the brand is what I'm doing at the moment.
And is Meta your go-to, the bulk of your worry arena?
It is, but it's a blessing and a curse, right? Because when you have some winners and do sort of go from strength to strength on Meta, you can easily get lost in that's banked revenue and that's always going to be there forever like that. And you know, things move so fast, it's not going to be the case. So we're really trying to diversify spend, to find new channels that can help us grow and also focus on retention, because we've acquired so many customers since Dragon's Den this time last year. We've now got a much bigger lifetime customer base than we ever had before. So how can we get those people back? How can we really focus on getting people to come to a second purchase far quicker than they ever did before? All of those things can actually help growth as well. I think when we talk about growth, everyone typically focuses on acquiring customers, and actually growth comes from so many different forms. And I think it's important to not forget that.
I think you mentioned that so many questions I could ask you off this, Ed. Right. So the first one though is, you mentioned that you're using Laura's story as a key part of your Facebook ads. And we often hear, you know, use the founder story, but so often brands fail to do it or fail to make it monetize. How have you approached that? Have you leveraged off the Dragon's Den? Have you leveraged off the founder story? How do you tie her into that successful ad story?
Yeah, I think Laura is not someone who wants to be on camera. So it's not something that necessarily comes natural. She's not here saying, I want to tell my story and that's how the brand can be famous. But people resonate with it. People appreciate that she was in the cleaning aisle in Tesco and saw that you had eco sprays, eco detergents, toilet rolls, but the actual cleaning essentials, the tools, the accessories that you use to clean your home with, every single one of them hadn't been sustainable-ified, and it was still full of plastic, and every sponge that you had was full of plastic, every cloth was full of plastic, and she felt that needed to be changed. And people resonate with that because, you know, the research out there is developing all the time. So it's her story, but it's also a story that clearly is out there to the masses and people care about it. And that's what we've sort of tapped into. The fact that it's her telling it that people can resonate has really worked. And then frankly, trying to showcase what is out there, like what you are using right now, you shouldn't be. You're doing harm to yourself. You're doing harm to the planet. And not to sort of scaremonger people, that's the opposite of what we want to do, but just trying to represent, you know, this is a problem and we're here to change that, and hopefully you can support the brand in doing so.
Nice. So it's both kind of like the values mission of the business as well as, you know, getting the founder out in front of people.
And I think it also, like so many brands, catch on to, oh, let's tell a founder story, and they force it. And actually what we've tried to do is really go with what feels natural, what people are resonating with, why customers bought us in the first place when we weren't spending on Meta, and then trying to do it in a more organic manner.
And you mentioned as well that you're using Meta both for growth. I was going to fall into the trap you warned us about earlier. I was going to say growth and retention. No, about acquisition and retention. Is that via the creative that you're trying to make that distinction? Is it literally you've got different campaigns and you're trying to do some targeting as much as you can these days with Meta on different audiences?
Yeah, I mean, most of our spend is about acquiring customers, but really most of our customers come to buy our hero product, which is our sponge scourer, and everyone else doesn't know what else we offer them. So it's basically about product selection and putting in front of people the sponge scourer, because that's what people come to seek for, but then targeting them with different products with range exploration in order for them to come back and make more changes in their home. So if it starts with the sponge, then it turns into the cloths that they're using and other accessories that they might use around the home.
I love the fact you mentioned that, because I find so many brands treat all products equally rather than realizing, right, that's our acquisition product and this is our customer lifetime value product base, if that makes sense. Was that something that, I mean, I'm guessing, given what you just told us, that's always been obvious with Seep. Is it something that you are forever reiterating into the marketing activity and the growth activity?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I didn't like it when I first came in. I was sort of advising Laura to think, you know, we need to change this. It's a devil that we've got one product that leads most of our acquisition, and that's a dangerous game to play. And what I've come to learn is, that's fine. Like you can have a hero SKU that most people buy, but what you've got to do a really good job of is the retention and CRM side of things. You've got to tell people what else you do. And I think it's about trying to understand, making people fall in love with the brand and what the brand stands for and what we're trying to do from a mission point of view. And that will make someone come back and explore other products and try other products. But you sort of don't hide away from the fact that there is one thing that people are coming in for originally.
And you mentioned the CRM there, so let's stray away from ads if we can. Is that an area where you've been doing a lot to increase those retention rates? Is CRM your biggest lever on the retention rate improvement front?
It is, but it's our ambition this year, really. I would say last year was a growth year from off the back of Dragon's Den, and it was very heavily new customer base. Was where the revenue was coming from. And that will be the case this year too. But we also want to make that pivot and start getting a larger proportion of people coming back for a second, third time. So we're doing quite a few initiatives there, from launching subscriptions for the first time and trying to get people to explore more of the range. And that is led by email and CRM in the main. That's the hope anyway.
With that CRM work, and this is something I often mull myself, are you finding that the most important impact on getting those repeat purchases and upgrading people to the subscription packages is what happens kind of immediately post-purchase, those 7 to 14 days after they purchased their first product? Or are you finding there's a lot of wealth in that long tail because of that Dragon's Den bump that came before you started, or just in general? How do you weight those two pieces of CRM activity?
So there obviously is an initial opportunity to make someone really feel great about the purchase they've just made. And we're trying to do that by telling the story, getting people to believe in the mission, and that will hopefully lead them to exploring alternative products immediately and pretty quickly after that first purchase. So that's one area. But we actually have a very long lead time on our sort of from first to second purchase, and that's because the sponges that we sell, that's been our acquisition driver, have been a year's supply of sponges. So that is every D2C brand's worst nightmare on paper. But actually, we use that to our advantage. That means that there is an intention to repurchase again. It runs out. You know exactly when it runs out, and you can plan around that. So it's about a year now from when we were aired on Dragon's Den. So there's a huge bulk of people who are ready to purchase again for a second time. And even though it seems like a long time for a 1 year sort of between first and second purchase, as long as you build the business economics around that, you can plan and make it perfectly work together.
Well, and if you get that solid and consistent, then you have a very good idea of how much product you need to buy.
Exactly.
And I would argue that the longevity of the product fits rather nicely with the values of the business, and manufacturing it to be only last a month would be detrimental in the longer term.
Exactly. And I think fundamentally people, again, you hear D2C brands, whatever sector it is, that you need second purchase inside the first 90 days and you need to be doing XYZ on the LTV and all that sort of thing. And actually, just take a step back for a minute. What is right for your business and for your product and for your customer base, and build the economics off of the back of that rather than forcing something. I really feel strongly about that.
And I suppose there's also the angle that gives you 12 months to cross-sell as well. You know, there's quite a clear window where there's only one message to give in the sales sense, which is, here's some other products that might help you.
Exactly. And what's the beauty of the brand for us is that people are using it every single day. And therefore you have a touch point and a sort of a thought going into someone's brain that, oh yes, this is the brand I use for my cleaning. So how can we therefore play off that and use that to our advantage? And we're very lucky in that respect. And hopefully that is why people are coming back, because they're thinking about us much more than, you know, another brand that's out there in a different sector.
And let's pivot back to the world of ads, because you mentioned about, you know, how Meta is constantly changing and you never know when something's going to fall off a cliff, be it the whole of Meta or be it another, you know, kind of hero ad campaign. Am I allowed to ask you, are you willing to share with the audience some of your kind of alternative backup plans to Meta, other things maybe you're testing or you're thinking of testing to give you that little bit of stability and slightly less reliance on the beast that is Meta?
Yeah, of course. No, I mean, nothing is unique particularly, and I imagine most brands are thinking about these things, but Google is easy first step. Like, we're diversifying spend by looking at Google's demand gen product, YouTube, like other areas to build reach and visibility and get eyeballs on the brand. It doesn't have to always be in Meta that you run video ads, and I think people forget that sometimes. Simply, how can you get eyeballs on the brand and reach? And Google has an amazing, quite cheap alternative to do that. So it doesn't have to always be through, you know, search-based advertising. So that's one way. And then, you know, a buzzword the last few years, but influencers, and doing it in a way which it's not about generating sales necessarily from the influencer channel. It's again about building eyeballs on the brand, visibility, getting reach, getting people to organically talk about your product, rather than, you know, paying extreme amounts to get someone to feature you. We're trying to speak to micro-influencers in the main and people that want to support you as a brand and care about your values, and getting those to spread the word, really. That's how we're trying to do it.
So more long-term engagements with influencers than here's 10 grand, do me one post and then we'll never talk again type stuff.
Exactly. Like, we, as a small brand, every penny matters, and we can't afford to do that. So therefore, how can you do it in a way which, you know, the digital platforms are where millions of people are consuming their media each day. So being as visible as you can on there and having 10 people talk about you in a week instead of one big person on paper, it's, I think, this sort of domino effect of that over time really builds up.
So Google go-to, but not just Google keywords and Google shopping campaigns, but actually explore the massive amount of opportunities there are within that Google Ads platform that you're right. I think so many people fail to actually go beyond PMax these days.
Exactly. And it's pretty unglamorous. I think people always just think it's, you know, a nice tag on to a campaign. We'll spend 5% of budget there, and actually it can be quite powerful if you step back and invest in something over time and see the effect, because people aren't consuming their media in the way that we buy that media. I mean, everyone needs to remember that. Like, people switch from Instagram to YouTube to whatever it might be within seconds on their phone. So therefore, trying to build up different areas and different channels to get that reach is important.
And what's your theory on in-house team or agencies? Are you doing this with a team in the business to do everything, create everything, run everything, or are you picking the best of the best in agency land?
Having been agency side, I think I might be biased, but I believe that, you know, agencies are often demonized, but I think you get the benefit of really skilled, talented people working on multiple brands at any given time, and therefore learning, seeing how different brands are interacting, what the trends are like, what sort of correlations you can make is a really powerful thing. Having it in-house, I definitely think we will do that one day, but right now it doesn't feel like the right place to be when we're still on sort of a growth trajectory, trying to learn as much as we can along the way too. So I think, yeah, I think agencies are perfectly placed to sort of lead this new wave of ads buying in a algorithm-based world.
Ed, let's do another big tack change. AI search, GEO, XEO, whatever we may be calling it, and the whole people buying from directly on Gemini or ChatGPT, etc. How much of your brain bandwidth are you giving to that at the moment? Or is it just there's too much to do day to day that we're just going to ignore that until it develops a bit more?
Being honest, I think it takes a lot of brain bandwidth in terms of how are we going to find a solution for this. But in terms of execution, we're not quite at that stage yet. And I need to get there quickly. We had quite a few conversations this week about how we can sort of be disciplined with our time to learn and develop and train and, you know, just engage with AI on a daily basis to understand what the capabilities are. Small things like how can you generate, you know, 100 static ads per month via AI instead of having to make every single one manually. That is something that is possible. So let's go and try and find a way to do that. And likewise, from a shopping point of view, making sure you're really covering the basis of good quality content on site, doing sort of SEO basics really, really well, I think is going to empower you to be featured in AI search platforms much more. So that's our bread and butter right now. We're trying to do the basics really well whilst forcing ourselves to spend a couple of hours a week on how can we find solutions for the future. I don't have a better answer than that right now, unfortunately, but I think a lot of people will probably be overwhelmed and in the same boat as me, but hopefully in the next few months I can try and crack it, and maybe we can revisit that question.
E-commerce Master Plan is supported by some of the greatest companies in the e-commerce sector. Here's a reminder of who they are. It's time for the top tips round.
Okay, I love this section because it gives me and our listeners some really quick ideas for taking our businesses to the next level. I promise, Ed, no more questions about AI search in any of this. Ed, are you ready for the top tips?
Let's do it.
Okay, the book top tip. If everyone listening to this podcast agreed to take Friday off and read a book to make their business better, which book would you recommend?
So it's actually a new book recommended by a friend a couple of weeks ago called Growth Levers and How to Find Them by Matt Lerner. And it's a new book. It's a new book to me, not a new book in general. But yeah, it has a really good message that 10% of initiatives drive 90% of business outcomes, yet people focus on so many small things day to day and get consumed by lots of things that don't drive business outcomes. So it really helps to sort of strip back the clutter, focus on your North Star, and understand how you can really deliver against that North Star day in, day out. So I'd recommend anyone who's in sort of growth world to have a look at that.
Nice. A bit of mindset as well as everything else is always so critical to a growth space. Traffic top tip. Which marketing method do you either prize above all others or think doesn't get the press it deserves?
We actually talked a lot about this and I didn't think we would. So I'm going to mention it again, unfortunately, but I think email as a channel, everyone obsesses over subscribers and how big your database is, but then do a pretty poor job of engaging said database and generating traffic to site. So I think as much as, you know, email has become this sort of known to be a spam channel, and I totally disagree with that. I think there are lots of brands doing it really well, and it can be a superpower when done in the right way and drive really hot, warm traffic to site on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, I think people just need to spend a bit more time and less time on Meta ads.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you. There is so much potential, but email is a much less noisy channel than, you know, the talk about email is so much less noisy than the talk about Meta ads. And therefore we all end up getting obsessed about our ads when we should be equally as obsessed about our email. So I think that's a great traffic top tip.
A brand I used to work for actually did completely turned off their ad spend because it wasn't working financially. And we focused solely on retention by email. And it actually worked really well. It helped to sort of take away all the stresses that you have from paid and look at things that you can control. And email absolutely is the channel for that. So I agree with you.
Yeah. Stress reduction strategy. 100%. Stop the advertising and focus on the email. Tool top tip then, maybe a collaboration tool, a social media plugin, a phone app, or just a way of working. Is there a cool little tool you use that makes you and your team more efficient from day to day?
I struggle with this question because I feel like I use a very typical tech stack myself personally, but I'm speaking to sort of the D2C operators here. But I've called out KnoCommerce, which is a post-purchase survey tool. And I love it. And I literally look at it every single day because it allows you to get thousands of responses per week on a couple of questions about how someone's consuming the media. Where did you hear about us? And that stuff really powerful. It's live data. How often do you get that sort of data from customers day in, day out? So yeah, I would recommend if you don't have a post-purchase survey to get one because they're cheap and easy. And it also is an amazing way to get daily powerful data.
It's a nice antidote to the nightmare that is attribution. I mean, obviously it's not perfect because the customers probably come through 20 different ways, but the thing which stuck in their head is the reason they purchased. You know, it's like a 10x factor on whatever that channel is in terms of its potential impact. So yeah, love that. And yeah, I think if I had one, I would be a little bit obsessed with the results too. First thing in the morning, check what people are saying. The carbon top tip, what's your favorite way to reduce the carbon footprint of an e-commerce store?
I think we, in the space we're in the sustainability space, we can feel quite passionate about this and go on quite a lot of rants about it. But I think looking at the entire journey from product conception to delivery is important, and trying to do small bits really well each day matters. So an example of that is we've stayed with Royal Mail for our distribution in the main for a certain amount of years because literally the whole country is getting deliveries from Royal Mail each day. And therefore we are making a small but important impact there by not using alternative courier companies and small things like, I think people obsess over carbon footprint, and if we did that as a brand, we would invest in plastic, which goes against our mission completely because there are low carbon footprint ways to have plastic packaging. So I think it's just one part of the sustainability process. And we also invest in a great charity called On a Mission, which is essentially like reforestation projects. It helps to look at the carbon impact of your business and invest in people's livelihoods and quality projects around the world that help to add carbon back into the world, basically. So yeah, I think not the best answer, but I think looking at the end-to-end process of your business and seeing how you can make small changes, I think they all add up.
I don't think that's a bad answer at all, because I think that your point about using the most common courier, you know, I live out in the sticks, like way out in the sticks, and I often think maybe the sustainability solution to delivering to us is to have a hub and one van that comes round for all the couriers. Because it's like, there are not enough people out where I live for it to be worth having DHL, DPD, the Royal Mail, Evri, whoever else fancies coming out for a drive around the countryside. It seems absolutely mad.
It's such a great point. It's actually a really good business idea. But I think, yeah, like, it would be cheaper for us to use an Evri or someone else than Royal Mail. That is true. But it also has an impact, and it would go against the values of our business if we were to make that decision. So I think it's important.
And there's the customer service element of the Royal Mail deliveries, because you rarely hear someone ranting about their Royal Mail postman.
Exactly.
It has to be said. Ed, thank you for being an awesome guest. Before we say goodbye, could you please let the listeners know where they can get in contact with you and find Seep?
Yeah, of course. Go to our website, theseepcompany.com, nice and easy, and at theseepcompany on Instagram. We've got some great cleaning hacks and all sorts of things that hopefully people will enjoy. And yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. Ed Hamilton is my name. So yeah, thanks very much.
Awesome to have you on the show. Thank you so much, Ed, for sharing so much insight with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
So there you have it. That's what head of growth at a fast growing D2C brand here in the UK is focused on right now. Taming the beast that is the everlasting beast, hopefully, that is Meta Ads, but also taking advantage of Google, really doubling down on CRM and devoting plenty of brain space to the world of AI search whilst getting those foundations right. Really cool to get to talk to Ed there. Let me know if you'd like us to get him on the podcast again in 6-12 months time and see how that's all evolving. Please let me know if you want us to do that. You can get your hands on the notes from this episode, including the top tips and links to what we've mentioned, by heading over to ecommercemasterplan.com. You can also go straight to the correct episode by using the short link ecmp.info/the number of this episode. When you get to the website, why not add yourself to my email list so you'll get my newsletter each week and updates about episodes and all other kinds of cool stuff we're up to. Now, if you like this episode, then make sure you check out episode 448 for more SEEP. That's when I got to chat with the founder, Laura Harnett, about how she took the business to £1 million in the first 12 months. Really cool episode. Lots of the kind of foundational story stuff of SEEP and growth stuff in there too. So that's episode 448. And if you want more on homewares businesses, ecmp.info/home for those on the website, and ecmp.info/B Corp if you want more stuff on B Corps. Lots for you to listen to there. Now, thank you for tuning in to this and every episode of the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. I bring you a new one every week because I want to inspire and help e-commerce business owners to succeed and thrive with their businesses, including progressing even along the path to net zero. So if you know someone this show can help, please tell them to listen to the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. I hope you have a great week and don't forget to keep optimizing.
Thank you for listening to the E-commerce Master Plan podcast. Find out more at ecommercemasterplan.com/podcast.